This is Fresh Air. Every week on the show, Ken Tucker reviews new rock records for us. But we save a spot at the new year for Ken to give us his favorite records of the year and to review some of the issues of the year in rock, pop, and rap. In Grammy Award history, 1990 will be remembered as the year the award for Best New Artist had to be given back. And tell me the truth, did you feel really cheated when you found out that Milli Vanilli didn't do the vocals themselves?
Oh, I felt delighted. I always kind of liked that song, Girl, You Know It's True. I always liked it a little, but now I like it a whole lot, knowing that it's phony to a certain extent. I think that this Vanilligate scandal this year is really the most interesting thing. I mean, it's the first postmodern pop scandal that I can think of that... That people would actually be scandalized that vocals aren't being done by this pop group. I mean, this kind of thing goes back to at least as far as the Monkees not playing on their records. There are other examples like, you know, Brian Wilson recording whole Beach Boys tracks where the other Beach Boys weren't around. I don't think it's that awful a thing to have happen. I think that Milli Vanilli is, at best, a tiny footnote in pop history. The best thing to come out of it is the whole revoking of the Grammy for Best New Artist. I think it will remind people how poor the Grammys' judgments have been about Best New Artists awards in the past. I mean, you know, A Taste of Honey and Christopher Cross and people like that have won Best New Artist Grammys in the past. I mean, I guess there is a level on which I feel a little sorry for lots of people who really idolize, especially young kids who idolize Milli Vanilli and had their faith in them destroyed by this. On the other hand, I think that it's kind of a useful lesson in pop showbiz.
Don't you think a lot of pop records have become producers' records anyways, and that the vocalists are so interchangeable? Because the way they're mixed, you can hardly make out what it is that's distinctive about their voice.
Yeah, I think increasingly it is more difficult to ascribe a real creator to a record, that sometimes it's the producer, sometimes it's the performer, sometimes it's, you know, the song itself that provides the hook that doesn't really matter how the song is constructed. And I think that when you have also added factors like MTV and videos that place such an emphasis on the visual, that there's a whole other area now that has to be taken into account. And it just kind of, Milli Vanilli, the phenomenon, was inevitable because of this emphasis that the three backup singers who really sang those Milli Vanilli vocals were apparently not photogenic enough to meet either the standards of the German producer, Frank Farian, who put that act together, or what he anticipated would be MTV's reaction if he had people who didn't dance and look wonderful.
I guess that's what troubles me the most about the, you know, the recent records, because there's another one too, the dance hit Everybody,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, the real singers didn't look good enough or didn't
right.
dance well enough to take
yes.
credit for their own voices. I mean, that bothers me.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an element, a very strong element of sexism there, that Black Box, that group, the lead singer was deemed not attractive enough to be put out front in that group, so they got this model to do it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that is annoying. Ultimately, it doesn't really bother me about the quality of the music, though.
Well, let's move on to another controversy of the year. Let's get to Madonna's new video for Justify My Love, which was too sexy for MTV, so now she's, what, marketing it herself?
Right. To me, Madonna is just the coolest this year. She's the rock figure of the year, as far as I'm concerned, not just with this Justify My Love controversy, but also things like her HBO concert that was broadcast from Paris, that, you know, just parents were having heart attacks right and left because she was using four-letter words and things like that. In the context of a great, great show, I might say, it wasn't just shock value. She also did a wonderful video for voter registration, part of MTV's Rock the Vote video, where she was ostensibly, you were supposed to think she was naked, wrapping herself in the American flag. I think that even her appearance on Nightline with Forrest Sawyer was just a great pop event of the year. I did regret that she wasn't there to justify my love with Ted Koppel, because I think that Koppel would have been a lot more shocked by the whole thing than Forrest Sawyer, and might have gotten like Henry Kissinger to come on and rebut Madonna's arguments or something. Forrest, I think, was too liberal. You know, he was going to go with it too much. But I think Madonna, although I think as music, Justify My Love is negligible, and I think that the album that she put out this year that was the music she recorded for the Dick Tracy soundtrack wasn't particularly good. I think that she really embodied a lot of issues that came up this year, just the whole idea of censorship and suppressing both words and images. And as she said on the Nightline appearance, she was celebrating sex in the Justify My Love video. And that takes an unbelievable amount of guts in the present pop context, I think, to even say that and to present that on the screen these days.
You've seen the video, right?
Yes.
It really reminds me of an Obsession ad, but more explicit.
Right.
You know, in this, in sex as fashion, mm-hmm. or sex as fashion statement, where there's a lot of very androgynous looking fashion model types in sexual or existential poses, or existential sexual poses. But it's so much more about pose than it is about sex, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's also much more about women's sexuality and women's fantasies than it is, and certainly in the context of MTV, which is almost an entirely male-oriented fantasy world in their videos. And I think that, yeah, that's true. I mean, ultimately, it's not great pop art, but certainly the controversy that it provoked is, I think.
There's one sequence in Madonna's video where she's kissing a very androgynous-looking person, and it's hard to tell whether it's a man who looks like a woman or a woman who looks like a man. And I find myself wondering, like, what would be more offensive to network executives? If she was kissing a man with lipstick, or if the person was actually a woman, would that be more offensive to them? That's fun to ponder.
It is. And it's amazing that those kinds of questions now have to pop into all of our minds in considering music. And I think that there's a real... I mean, the serious aspect of this is that I think there's a lot of self-censorship going on among popular artists, whether it's in music or any other art form for that matter, that people are really beginning to think before they do something, is this going to get on the air? Is this going to be published? Is this going to be the target for a lot of attacks?
Okay, Ken, we've talked about these controversies of the year. What about the music that the controversies grew out of? Do you think that the music really stands up as being important in itself?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that my selections for what I would say are the best records of the year don't have anything to do with the music that made rock and roll a force in the culture this year. I think that there's a kind of fundamental disjunction in the music that it's almost as if there's a body of work that operates as art, and then there's another body of work that serves the music's kind of responsibility as social documentation and provocation. I think that although certainly my list of the best records of the year would differ with a lot of critics, I think that to a certain extent, you know, something like Neil Young's Ragged Glory, which for my money is the best record of the year and will probably turn up, I would think, on a lot of critics' lists, there's certainly nothing in that that to compare with the kind of timeliness and provocative response that Madonna or Two Live Crew or anyone else embroiled in controversies would provoke. And yet I think that Neil Young has made the kind of best, straightforward, loud, just really, really admirable rock and roll record of the year.
Why don't we play something from that album, the album you called the best album of the year? What would you like to hear from it?
I'd really like to hear this roiling song called Over and Over.
Thank you.
That's Neil Young from his album Over and Over. It's on Rock Critic Ken Tucker's list of the best albums of the year. And that reminds me that if you'd like a copy of his list of the best albums of the year and some of the best singles and the best reissues of the year, just drop us a line. We'll give you the address a little later. Drop us a line and a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send you his best of the year list. Well, what else is on your best of the year list?
Well, in no particular order, I really liked, I thought, a couple of sorely neglected albums this year. Very early this year, Nick Lowe put out an album called Party of One, which I thought was really wonderful. Nick Lowe hadn't recorded in about 5 or 6 years, and I thought that this songwriting on this was really terrific and witty, and I thought he did a really good job. Another record that I liked a lot, which sank without a trace, was by Amy Lorraine and the Family Affair. I played a song or two of this a couple of weeks ago. The album was called Starring In, Standing In a Monkey See. And I really thought that it was a terrific, up-to-the-minute pop record that combined, Amy Lorraine is a white singer who combined a lot of black influences, going back to, I heard Sly and the Family Stone and Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye in her influences, and I thought it was really good. I also like this record by the Vaughan brothers. Stevie Ray Vaughan, of course, died this year, but before he died, he got together with his brother Jimmy, and they recorded their first album together called Family Style. I thought that was a really terrific record. I'd never been a real fan of Stevie Ray Vaughan. I thought that his blues records had a certain derivativeness, that kind of pervasive Jimi Hendrix influence that bothered me when I listened to his albums, but I thought that by sort of moving past the blues to record rhythm and blues with his brother, that those songs were really terrific.
Rock Critic Ken Tucker is with us talking about some of the best records of the year. Give us more of the records that's on your list.
I really like this album that Warner Brothers put out called The Carl Stalling Project. I really like this collection of music by Carl Stalling, who did all the music for the Looney Tunes, Warner Brothers, Merry Melodies cartoons. It's not rock and roll in any conventional sense, but it is popular music, I think, in the finest sense. And I like that a lot. At the other end of the spectrum, I think that this new album called The Future by Guy, a rhythm and blues trio that's headed up by Teddy Riley, who's a very important rhythm and blues producer and songwriter right now. I thought that was a terrific album. It had a real good combination, I thought, of fast songs and ballads. The fast songs Guy calls New Jack Swing is the term that Teddy Riley has coined for that, and I thought that's a real sort of cutting-edge pop record.
What does New Jack Swing mean?
It means that essentially, I mean, it doesn't mean anything literally that I can figure out, but it does mean a kind of incorporation of rap rhythms and speaking of lyrics over dance music or house music rhythms and music.
What would you like to play from the Guy album?
Well, I think a perfect example of this New Jack Swing style is a song called Wanna Get With You.
Yo, drop it. I wanna get with you. Let's get together. Come on. So let's get together.
That's Guy from the album The Future, one of the albums on Rock Critic Ken Tucker's list of the best records of the year. You want to read off the remaining albums on the list?
Yeah, let's see. What haven't we covered? I really enjoyed Brian Eno and John Cale's album Wrong Way Up, Kate and Anna McGarrigle's album Heartbeats Accelerating, the Traveling Wilburys Volume 3, which really grew on me as the year went on, and an album by Shoes, this little Zion, Illinois trio, and their album was called Stolen Wishes, which I think is the perfect pop rock album of the year.
Now, I know that there were some albums this year that you didn't like very much, but there was a single within the record that you thought was quite good. Maybe you have a list of those you could tell us.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really terrific singles. The band called World Party put out a song called Put the Message in the Box, which was the video was a big hit on MTV, and it got a lot of sort of screen time that way. But as far as radio airplay, it was kind of minimal. But I thought that was a terrific song. I thought that Prince's album, Graffiti Bridge, didn't hold up as the year went on, but I thought that the single from that album, Thieves in the Temple, was terrific. I also have a couple of guilty pleasures. I really like Wilson Phillips' Hold On, and I can hear the snickers of derision from your audience about this, but because you're not supposed to like Wilson Phillips because they're kind of bubblegummy and that kind of thing, but I think it's a really good pop song. I thought, for the same reason, MC Hammer's song, Pray, the most overtly Christian message of the year and the most palatable one, I thought, in pop music. The Soup Dragons had an album out that yielded one terrific song called I'm Free.
Well, Ken, I hope you have a good year in 91.
Well, thanks. You too.
And thanks a lot for reviewing the year in rock and pop and rap, and Happy New Year.
Well, same to you. Thanks a lot.